From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Ghosts of Birchin Hall. Tyneside has several reputed haunted mansions, among them Churton Hall, at one time the seat of the Argylls. The mistress of one of the dukes, locally known as Silky, is said to have haunted the house for many years. Birchin Hall, owned by Major Hugo de Laval, also had its several ghosts. For years at a time it stood untenanted. During one of these periods, a Mr. Raw and a Mr. Hook, two friends interested in psychical research, asked permission to spend a few nights in the house. Major de Laval granted them permission. They went to the house one fine day in September, arriving about 6 o'clock in the evening, and after a meal prepared for them by the caretaker, Mrs. Emmett, they strolled about the extensive and well-kept grounds. It was a very still night, with hardly a breath of wind. Away in a distant field, cows stood motionless in the moonlight. Both men were smoking and every now and then talking quietly. They were on a path fringed with bushes when they saw, suddenly approaching them, a woman in a dark dress. As she drew nearer, they saw she was about 30 years of age, with dark hair and eyes, and there was something very forbidding in her face. "I wonder who she is," Hook said. "Probably a relative of the caretaker, maybe her daughter," suggested his companion. The woman left the path and disappeared from view, and they thought no more about her. They stayed outdoors for some time longer, and then went into the house, had drinks by the drawing-room fire, and then retired to bed in their adjoining bedrooms. Tired with the day's traveling, they both soon fell asleep, and slept till morning. The next day they explored the house. It was a low, rambling building, with many gables, mullioned windows, long, winding corridors, dark nooks and corners, and steep staircases. There was a gloom about it which the daylight could not dispel. In the evening, the two men went into the grounds again after a meal. They were walking in the same path and talking, and once again they saw the woman with the forbidding face. They saw this time that she looked foreign, and when she got nearer to them, they noticed that her dress seemed to be very old-fashioned, belonging to a bygone age. She pounced without seeming to notice them, and they turned and looked after her. They were struck by a shadowy indistinctness about her which they had not noticed before, and the fact that her high heels made no sound on the hard ground. After walking for some time longer in the garden, they went indoors and sat for a while by the drawing-room fire. They then went to their respective bedrooms. Raw had a fire in his room and sat for some time reading a book he had brought with him. Then, tired and made drowsy by the fire, he fell asleep in his chair. He awoke with a start to hear the sound of high heels tapping along the corridor outside his room. Instantly all his faculties tensed. He sat bolt upright listening. The tapping drew quickly nearer. It seemed as if the wearer of the high-heeled shoes was running. She passed his door. There were sounds of a distant struggle and a fearful spine-chilling scream. After that, an eerie silence. Raw quickly rose from his chair, opened the bedroom door, and looked up and down the corridor. All was very still and deserted. The moonlight poured through an oriel window at the nearest end of the corridor, illuminating it with cold white light, while ivy leaves, blown by the night breeze, tapped against the window. Puzzled, he drew back into his room and got into bed, sleeping soundly till the caretaker brought him a morning cup of tea. "Ghosts?" Mrs. Emmett said, when Raw told her about what he had heard. "There aren't such things. You must have heard an owl. They do make queer sounds." The woman they had seen in the garden must have been some person taking a shortcut home through the grounds, she said. They did sometimes, and nothing could convince her to the contrary. The house was not haunted. Raw then told Hook about the sounds in the corridor, and Hook, who had not heard them, nevertheless declared his intention of not going to bed that night. He would sit up and keep a vigil. The two men spent their last day at Birchin Hall just roaming about, and in the evening, after their meal, strolled as usual in the grounds. In the same place, at the same time, they again suddenly saw the woman with a forbidding face. She came steadily towards them. As she was about to pass, Hook stood deliberately in front of her, but she passed right through him, without swerving or apparently seeing them, and continued on her course. Considerably shaken, both men turned and looked after her, and again they noticed the shadowy indistinctness about her and the quaintly old-fashioned dress. Hook, being not a little jarred by his strange experience, later declined to go straight to his own bedroom and sat for a time in Raw's room before the fire. The heat from the fire made both men drowsy, and they fell asleep. They awoke simultaneously to hear the pattering of high heels in the corridor, the footfalls moving very quickly. Raw jumped up and threw the door open. Running along the corridor was a shadowy figure of an elderly woman, her face convulsed with terror, and pursuing her, a horn-handled knife in one hand, was the forbidding-faced woman of their earlier encounters, her expression one of diabolical hatred and exultation. The two figures, seen very clearly by both men, vanished round an angle in the long corridor. There were sounds of a struggle and a blood-curdling scream of terror, then silence. "That's enough for one night," Hook gasped. "I can't stand any more of it." He remained for the rest of the night in Raw's room, and they left the house after breakfast, calling on Major de Laval to tell him of their experience. He listened to the story with great interest and told them that according to a family tradition, one of his ancestors, Sophia de Laval, had been murdered in the house by Marie Blucher, her French companion, who robbed her and got away without ever being seen again. What Raw and Hook had witnessed was evidently a reenaction of the crime. Marie Blucher, the major said, had connived in getting the servants out of the house on the night of her attack, so that she had got Sophia to herself, alone and defenseless, and she had used the knife with all the strength of a man. The man who came back. A strange story was told me many years ago by Frederick Blake, a retired civil servant. The incident happened in the 60s of the last century. Blake went one night with his friend and fellow civil servant named Parker to Kate Hamilton's club in Gerrard Street, a rendezvous in the West End of London, which vied for popularity at that time with Cremorne, the Argyle Rooms, and Maltz Kate, who was the queen of the demi-mondes, was in the employment of Isaac Larts, who seldom visited the club himself, and left the management of it to Kate. On the two men arriving at the entrance, Parker, who was a member of the club, gave the password to a porter, who rang a bell twice as a signal to another porter at the end of a long passage that all was right. Going along the passage and passing through the door at the end of it, Blake and Parker entered a long, rather narrow room ablaze with gaslight. It was luxuriously furnished. There was a bar at one end, and many tables, seated at which were the patrons of the club, a mixed crowd of civil servants, army officers, university students, men of the church and law, members of parliament, and men of independent means. There was an army of waiters, the chief of whom was called Spurgeon, owing to his likeness to a preacher of that name. Seated in a gorgeous armchair in front of the bar was Kate Hamilton, bedecked with jewels. A cabinet minister was paying her homage. There were also present many women whose appearance suggested they were demi-mondes, mistresses of wealthy men and the most highly paid of prostitutes. There was much talking and laughing, the men treating the women to drinks sold at high cost. Kate got a commission on all the drinks. This very clear word picture of the place given to me by Frederick Blake should be borne in mind when considering the next part of his narrative. It was, he said, the early hours of the morning before the company left, leaving the premises in a very upside-down state. He and Parker went off together, as they lived near one another, and Blake told me, though they were pleasantly warmed, they were very far from intoxication. They were walking along Piccadilly when they saw, coming towards them, George Payne, one of their old schoolfellows. Payne was in the army, and his regiment was in New Zealand. They supposed he must be home, on leave. Walking a little way in front of them was a hospital nurse. As Payne drew nearer to them, his figure became clearer. There was no mistaking him. They knew so well his walk. He paused when he got to Albemarle Street. His face then showed up with startling clearness, and Blake and Parker started with horror, for what they looked on was the face of the dead, gray and lifeless. The nurse walking in front of them also having looked hard at Payne, turned very startled, took to her heels and ran across the street. The two friends watched Payne until he vanished from view and went home, much troubled. Some weeks later, they heard that George Payne had been killed in a military skirmish. His death occurred at the very time they had seen his wraith in Piccadilly. Cases of people appearing elsewhere at the moment of their deaths are not uncommon, though such well-authenticated accounts are, especially where there is more than one witness. Yet, the number of instances of this ghostly occurrence allows little room for skepticism. Through many years, there have been faithfully sworn accounts of these apparitions. For example, the occasion when Lord Balcarres, confined in Edinburgh Castle under suspicion of being a Jacobite, was visited in the night by the wraith of his friend Viscount Dundee, who had been killed at the Battle of Killiecrankie. In more recent times, the Great War, understandably with its masses of casualties, produced many stories of visitations to their kin of soldiers who died. I have been acquainted with a number of stories of this nature, and there is one incident very close to me. A girl of my acquaintance named Blythe was engaged to John Crawford, a young officer serving at the Western Front in 1918. One evening, as she was sitting at the drawing-room window, she saw him, to her surprise, come up the garden path. She hastened to the front door to greet him, but found no one there. Thinking he was hiding in fun, she called out to him. There was no reply, and when she looked for him in the garden, there was not a trace of him. A few days later, she learned that he had been killed in battle, his death occurring at the same time she saw his wraith. Away from war, there are other instances of this phenomenon. Not long ago, the young members, four in number, of a South Wales family went for an excursion one day in a steamer. That evening, their parents, who were watching for their return at the drawing-room window, saw them come up the garden path in single file. They both ran to the front door to greet them, but no one was there, nor was there a sign of them in the garden, only a sense of brooding depression. Hours afterwards, the parents learned that the pleasure steamer had been wrecked and all on board her had drowned. In cases where the visitation of the newly dead occurs only fleetingly, as a face seen at the foot of the bed, perhaps it is often claimed that these are figments of the imagination or dreams, but dreams themselves are often the instrument of the supernatural. Frederick Kane of Herwain Street, Barry Dock, dreamed one night that he saw his brother Henry, who had migrated to New York, standing on the quayside of the River Hudson, counting his money, while around him were the dark, sinister forms of men. They gradually drew menacingly nearer and nearer to Henry. When the men were close to him, and seemingly about to pounce on him, Frederick awoke. The dream was so terribly realistic that he could not erase it from his mind. He instigated inquiries about Henry Kane, and was informed that his brother was last seen on the quayside of New York, and after that nothing more was heard of him. He disappeared. To meet Frederick seemed sure a tragic end. Another even stranger case of the supernatural visiting a person in his dreams occurred in 1835 in Glasgow. James McLary was returning home one day when he met William Wright, an acquaintance who looked somewhat disturbed, and asked him if he believed in dreams. McLary replied that he did not, whereupon Wright said he had dreamed that his friend James Imrie had stabbed him suddenly with a knife he used for cutting leather. Imrie was a shoemaker. Wright declared he could never forget the awful face Imrie had made when he made the stabbing stroke. McLary told Wright to forget the dream and left him. Some days later, McLary was in the same street when he heard loud cries of murder, and Wright rushed to him, a bloody knife in his hand. "I've killed Imrie," he said. "In his house, I went to see him, and he made the same hideous face I'd seen him make in my dreams. Feeling sure he was about to kill me, I stabbed him, and oh my God, he is dead. I've killed him." Wright was seized by the police, who told him that Imrie was not dead. When Wright heard this, he wept for joy. "Thank God," he cried, "I am not a murderer after all." His joy was, however, premature, for Imrie died that night in hospital. Wright's impassioned defense that the dream was answerable for Imrie's death carried no weight. He was found guilty of murder and executed. The Night Hounds. Of all the ghosts of animals, dog phantoms would seem to be the most common. One of the best-known dog ghosts is the big, terrifying dog phantom that is said to haunt the borders of Dartmoor. It is believed to be the ghost of the bad Lady Howard, who is credited with the murder of one husband, if not more. In Wales, a phantom mastiff has been seen to haunt country lanes and woods and is described as the most alarming and evil specter. A farmer was returning home one night along a lane leading to the Liswary Crossways in Monmouthshire, when his horse suddenly shied, pitching him from the saddle, and showing great terror, bolted for home. The farm servants, finding the horse, set off in search of their employer, and found him lying on the ground. He declared he had seen the phantom mastiff. It took him some days to recover from the shock and fall he had received. In Norfolk and Cambridgeshire, there's an equally terrifying dog called the shag or shuck, which is said to haunt churchyards and lonely spots. One of its special places, called Shuck's Lane, is near Overstrand in Norfolk. In the neighborhood of Leeds, there is a big, shaggy-haired phantom dog known by the name of Padfoot. To see it is a portent of death. According to Baring Gould, a Horbury man was going home one night when he saw a big white dog in a hedge. He aimed a blow at it, and a stick passed right through it. He went home greatly frightened, fell ill, and died. In Northumberland, Durham, and Yorkshire, there are visitations by a great spectral hound, and in parts of Lancashire, a large black hound with fiery eyes is believed to portend a death. These phantoms have been seen from time to time, not only by possibly superstitious country folk, but by people who beforehand were, to say the least, highly skeptical of such things. In a valley between Darlington and Houghton, there's a phantom dog which is said to howl and bark before the death of anyone in the locality. The River Bella in Westmoreland was for years haunted by a terrifying phantom dog, though this was eventually exorcised. From the lone dog phantoms to the packs of spectral hounds, a sight of these is said to bring misfortune, sometimes even death, to the seer. Dartmoor is haunted by the Yesk or Wisk phantom hounds. In Wales, there are the phantom Cern Awn, and in Cornwall, the devil and his dandy dogs. J.Q. Couch, in his Folklore of a Cornish Village, relates the appearance of the devil and his dandy dogs to a farm laborer. The man was returning home late one night when he heard the baying of hounds. They were phantom dogs. There was no mistaking the supernatural tone of the baying, and they were following him. Forced to look back, the man saw to his horror not only the diabolical hounds, but also their infernal huntsman master, who had horns and a tail, and was like the description of him. In his despair, the man fell to his knees and prayed for deliverance from the powers of evil, whereupon hounds and devil halted for a moment and then vanished. In the vicinity of Cliviger in Lancashire, there are the Gabriel Ratchets. A Sheffield man, when passing one night a lonely churchyard on his way home, distinctly heard them. An old man, passing along a lane near the Devon village of St. Mary Tavy, during the last century heard the howling and barking of the Yeth spectral pack of hounds. Legends of wild huntsmen riding with packs of spectral hounds abound throughout Europe. The most famous of all occult hunts is that of Herne the Hunter, who, according to general belief, was a forester at Windsor in the reign of Henry VIII. Since his death, for some unknown reason, he and his pack of spectral hounds have haunted Windsor Castle grounds. The last recorded appearance of Herne the Hunter was towards the end of the last century, when his hounds dashed past two boys on their way back through Windsor Park to Eton College. In the forests of Fontainebleau, a pack of spectral hounds is hunted by Hugh Capet. Henry IV is said to have seen this spectral hunt when hunting one day shortly before his assassination. A similar phantom pack haunts a forest in Blois and another forest in the Midland region of France. There are several packs of hellish hounds in Germany, chiefly in the region of the Black Forest and the Harz Mountains. In a forest near Danzig, the wild huntsman is known as Dietrich von Bern. In Schleswig, one of the forests is haunted by spectral hounds, headed by the ghost of Duke Abel, who murdered his brother and committed many other crimes. According to tradition, Bell was swallowed up in a morass close to the River Eider when on a marauding expedition. His body was recovered and buried in a cathedral at first and afterward in a marsh. The spot became haunted by the most blood-curdling cries and groans, and the ghost of Abel was said to be seen on a phantom horse accompanied by three horrible-looking phantom hounds. All attempts to lay his ghost have failed. Ghosts known as Kirkgrims have been seen to haunt churchyards. These have appeared as dogs, though they can take many different forms, including occasionally that of a pig. Many attempts to catch and stop the Kirkgrims have been made, and all have failed. There are several recorded accounts of phantom bears. One dark winter's night, a soldier on a sentry duty outside the guardhouse of the Tower of London saw the luminous figure of a large bear come up the stairs from a cellar. Terribly scared, he thrust at it with his bayonet, and on the bayonet passing through it without any effort, he fainted. He was found lying unconscious on the ground and carried to the guardroom. He recovered sufficiently to narrate what he had seen, but died in a few days. The phantom was thought to be that of one of the bears kept at the Tower years ago. A house in Cheyne Walk, Chelsea, is said to be haunted still by a phantom bear. It is thought to be the ghost of a bear baited in the days of bear baiting. The house is sited on land that formerly belonged to Henry VIII, who numbered bear baiting among his favorite amusements. The House of the Blue Lights. Though my lifelong interest has been ghost hunting, I have not spent all my time looking out for ghosts. And in fact, one of my strangest experiences came about purely by chance. It happened in the 1920s, and although I had at this time been active in a number of investigations, ghosts and hauntings were very far from my mind when I took the train across London to visit a little country place in Essex. It was noon when I arrived there, and about 7 p.m., when I set out on my return journey. By way of variety, I decided to walk 3 or 4 miles across a very pretty bit of country with which I was totally unfamiliar, and then train the rest. The night was dark, heavy black clouds completely obscuring the moon and stars. After I had proceeded about 2 miles along a fairly level track of country, the road dipped, and I found myself descending into what appeared to be a rather thickly wooded valley. It is not often I feel depressed, really depressed, but as I plunged further and further down into that very silent vale, I became strangely influenced by the surroundings. I seemed to be so utterly alone, cut off from every evidence of human life and habitation, that I could scarcely credit I was in reality less than 20 miles from London. Walking steadily on, I eventually arrived at the foot of the decline. Here I halted, and I was peering about in the dark when my attention was attracted by a dull, glimmering light in among the trees on the one side of the road. It did not seem to proceed from a house, and there was something about it which puzzled me. Curious to ascertain its origins, I climbed over a low fence, and advancing toward the light with every caution, for the ground seemed full of pit holes, I soon found myself on the edge of an open piece of ground. While I was debating what to do next, whether to press still further forward or remain where I was, another light appeared, somewhat bigger than the other, but of the same peculiar leadenish, unhealthy blue. Then, very abruptly, both lights disappeared. There was now a brief interval in which nothing happened, and then, straight in front of me, there was a flash of light that lit up the scenery all around, and I was able for the first time to get some idea of my surroundings. I was in either a park or garden, but one which had long ceased to be cultivated, for everywhere were signs of neglect and confusion. Fallen branches across walks, stacks of dead leaves, rank weeds, and debris of all kinds. Away behind all this loomed a great building, festooned to the chimney pots with ivy. I had no time to see more, for the light disappeared with the same startling abruptness as it had become, and I was once again plunged into darkness. I had seen the will-o'-the-wisp, but these flashing blue lights appeared to me to be essentially different, and more like what are in certain parts of Wales called corpse candles or churchyard candles. These are most frequently seen before death, though they have been known to manifest themselves in some locality where death from unnatural causes has taken place. For example, at crossroads in Monmouthshire, where a murderer who had been gibbeted was buried, has been periodically haunted, generally at Christmas Eve, by a blue flame fashioned like a giant candle. I waited some time for recurrence of the lights, and as none came, and the cold from the damp ground began to penetrate my clothes, I finally retraced my steps to the road and continued my journey in the dark. The following day, I again took the train across London and made inquiries in the neighborhood regarding the house, and discovering the name of the agent in whose hands it was, decided to approach him to ask permission to keep an all-night vigil there. By a stroke of luck, the agent turned out to be someone I had met some years before, and to whom I had introduced a certain amount of business. He listened to my account of the lights quite gravely, and shaking his head remarked, "No, I cannot explain them, nor have I ever heard of anyone else seeing them. The property has stood empty and is in a bad state of repair." "Is there any story attached to it?" I asked. "There are too many old houses," he replied evasively, "and if there are none to begin with, people invent them. If you would like to see over the place, I will write you an order." "Could I stay there for the night?" I asked, "if I promised not to divulge any names?" "I think that could be managed," he said. "There is no need of a key, for nearly all the windows at the back of the premises are broken, so you can get in easily. You are not likely to be disturbed when once you are there, because, from what I understand, no one ventures near the grounds after nightfall. If you do experience anything, let me know, as I should like to hear about it." He then wrote me an order to view, which I still have, and I quitted his presence with many thanks. This conversation took place one Monday in November, but owing to a succession of disasters, I was kept from fulfilling my intention to ghost hunt till Christmas Eve, which is, by the way, one of the nights of the year most favorable to the experiencing of ghost manifestations, when wraiths are to be met at crossroads, in and around old burial places, in spots that have tempted people to put an end to their existence, and in crime-stained mansions. On this occasion, I had decided against a lone vigil and arranged for someone to accompany me, and it was only at the last moment I received a wire from him saying he was down with a severe cold and could not come. Hence, armed with a torch and a box of sandwiches, I set off alone. Houses look different in the daytime, and when I once again clambered over the wooden fence and approached the spot where I had stood and watched the lights, I could hardly believe it was the same building. It was in a slight hollow with a cluster of very tall trees on either side of it, and as I approached it, the crows perched in the topmost branches greeted me with hoarse croaks. It was a huge house with high narrow windows and jalousies, Italian style, and a ponderous hall door studded with iron nails like that of a door of a cathedral. There was no difficulty in gaining admittance, as several of the lower windows were entirely empty of glass. I got in through a window close to a door and found myself in a stone-flagged passage. As one would naturally suppose, the place smelt very damp and earthy, and I now became conscious of a sense of loneliness and depression, somewhat akin to what I experienced the night I saw the lights. The front portion of the house was in a trifle better condition. Crawling insects held high holiday on the once polished boards of the vast entrance hall, while cobwebs festooned the oak-paneled walls, but there was no bad decay nor any excessive damp. On ascending the main staircase, the sense of depression increased, and I now got for the first time a very unpleasant, eerie feeling, which I had some difficulty in overcoming. Each step I took awoke 101 long, reverberating echoes, like were quite alarming in their intensity and queer sound of hollowness. It was not easy to write it all off to suggestion. Although it was broad daylight, the long corridors that confronted me on the first floor were swathed in gloom and laden with shadows. The rooms, too, were dark with shadows and full of a sense of loneliness. I went everywhere in the building and satisfied myself that there was no one in hiding, then retired to the entrance hall, and throwing open the windows to let in the fresh air and thin sunshine, sat down there and had my lunch. I then whiled away the afternoon wandering around the extensive grounds and having tea in a village some mile or so distant, and towards evening returned to the house to commence my ghost hunting in earnest. It was about 7 o'clock when I re-entered the grounds, and approaching the house by a long gravel path, hedged in on either side by laurel and other bushes, the moon was now out, and its beams illuminated the scene with a cold silvery glow. I was looking determinedly ahead, for I did not altogether relish the prospect of a night alone in that very gloomy, utterly deserted building, when I suddenly saw a figure. It was that of a girl, a slight, tallish girl clad in a white frock with a dark cloak over it. She wore no hat, but her hair hung in a mass of bright disorder over her shoulders. She was hurrying towards me and carrying in one bare hand a pail which shone and sparkled in the moonlight. I could not see her face with any degree of distinctness, because it seemed somehow to be in the shadows, continually in the shadow. When she got within about 20 feet of me, she abruptly turned down a side path and disappeared from view. Directly I reached this path, I looked down it, and there she was, still hurrying along, and still carrying the pail, which gleamed so brightly by her side. In a few seconds, however, seeming somehow to amalgamate with the moonbeams, she vanished. I went to the spot where she had disappeared. It was hedged on either side by a thick growth of laurels. I looked everywhere, but could find no trace of her, and though I listened intently, I could detect no sound of footsteps. I then recollected that I had not previously heard any, that she had walked with absolute silence. Neither her feet nor the bucket she was carrying made any sound whatsoever. Struck with the oddness of it, I now hurried to the house, and entering the same way as before, I looked around in search of a likely spot for my vigil. I eventually selected a room on the first floor. It led into a small archway situated about halfway down a long narrow passage, at one end of which was a bay window, and at the other a very gloomy recess. There being no chairs, I seated myself on the window sill in the empty room, and with a torch at my side, ready for instant use, awaited events. The night was icy, typical of Christmas, but fine. Away down below, the gravel drive glittered in the moonbeams, while further off a belt of larch and fir trees threw dense black shadows on the unkempt grass. There was not a breath of air, not a branch stirring, no noise of any sort to be heard, and the distant sound of a church clock striking 8 broke the silence with a startling distinctness. Of course, I soon began to hear things. One always does in houses, especially long-disused houses. From somewhere close at hand, some water dripped. Then a board gave a creak, and presently there was a slight scurrying sound in the passage, which I assured myself was mice or rats. I nerved myself to go and look, and saw nothing, only bare moonlit walls and endless shadow. I returned to my seat by the window in the empty room and waited again. 9, 10, 11 o'clock went by and nothing happened, and then at last midnight came, ushered in by irritatingly slow and ponderous boomings from the distant clock. A moment later, from the passage outside, came a regular measured tap-tap, as of shoes on a polished oak floor, faint but distinct and growing nearer and nearer. I admit I was startled. On and on the footsteps came, cautiously yet firmly, tap, tap, tap. I forced myself to the door and listened. On and on came the steps till they reached the doorway. Then there was a frightful scream followed by unnerving silence. When some moments afterwards I found courage to look out into the passage, there was nothing to be seen. I left the house and walked to the railway station in the village, where I sat on the platform in the cold of Christmas morning, waiting an eternity for a train. A week later I returned to the house agent and narrated to him all the incidents of my adventure. This time he was less evasive and more open with me, and confessed that my experience tallied to a remarkable extent with the many rumors about the house which had been spread. The place, he said, is claimed to be haunted about this time every year by the ghost of an ancestress of the present owner. She was strongly suspected of having committed a most atrocious crime, and as a punishment for her sins, it is said that she is compelled to walk the house in the guise too hideous for human eyes to look upon without either going mad or dying on the spot. I believe it actually happened some years ago that she did reveal her face to the then owner of the property. She never reveals it to strangers, and he died hours afterwards. As the present owner of the house did not encourage further investigation, I had to leave the matter there, though I should have liked to have inquired more about the girl with the pail.